morning and welcome to Criminal Justice Insider. I'm Babs Rawls-Ivey, and that is...
Jeff Grant.
How are you all today?
Morning, Babs.
Good morning. So let me get the housekeeping out of the way.
Oh, no, first, sponsors first.
That's what I'm doing.
Oh, okay.
So this show is brought to you by the kindness of the Community Foundation of Greater New Haven.
Now more than ever.
And a family reentry.
Serving the justice community since 1984.
Thank you.
Nice job, Babs.
So, everybody knows on social media that we have Mayor Ganim here from Bridgeport.
We do.
So we're going to have that conversation. But before we get there, if y'all pick up the Greenwich magazine.
Uh-oh.
There is Jeff Grant in living color, looking beautiful. So he's on page 118, and it's the redemption of Jeff Grant. It's a beautiful layout.
You know, Babs, we gave that interview, Lynn and I gave that interview in October. And, we feel blessed and honored that our stories in Greenwich Magazine, especially since we've lived in Greenwich for all that time. And hopefully we can reach out to some people who are suffering in silence and help them. And give them the permission and power to tell their stories, too. You know, it's powerful.
And that there is life on the other side of whatever the trouble is.
We know about that, Beth.
Yes, we do. We do. So, good morning, Mayor Ganim.
Well, good morning to you.
How are you?
I'm really good. I clear my throat a little bit. Really good. I just came down from Waterbury.
Uh-huh.
Had a breakfast meeting there. And in the midst of everything that's going on, city side certainly, which some real positive stuff going on. But, you know, cities are always, as I say, work in progress. Last night we were up in Torrington, and before that elsewhere in the state, just trying to get around close to people wherever we can,
mm-hmm.
communicate with them, let them see, feel, touch, you know. I mean, that's what it's about, right?
Well, there goes that. Yeah. There goes that campaign.
All right. No, I'm not even gonna...
So you're running for governor.
Yes. It's an important time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big challenge,
mm-hmm.
and certainly with our topics today, I think it's good to allow all of us, whoever's running, whoever wants to be in public service, you know, there's that whole element of being kind of real, but being able to let people, as I said, I use the terms I did, see, feel, talk, whatever, but know you a little bit, and mm-hmm. hope we can do some of that on the show this morning.
Yes!
I got some... very real people here with me who have not been afraid to just kind of talk about it, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we can do some of that this morning and then talk about things that are important. I think for your listeners, aside from maybe me or us, that's important to them for their future, maybe challenges they've experienced and things that I think if, you know, whether a mayor or continue to serve in public service in some form can be a voice for,
mm-hmm.
and maybe we can work together on making things better, collectively. So,
you know,
I look forward to it.
You know, Mayor, I was at the Criminal Justice Conference yesterday at CCSU in New Britain. 300 people in the room, a lot of fine speakers. Some, in fact, John Santa was one of the moderators. He'll be here on the 16th, head of Multi Justice Initiative, and who introduced me and Babs, actually. And I kid you not, half that room came up to me before during the networking hour and was interested in this show and you, because it's an opportunity to speak to the criminal justice community, who's our audience, and you know, let them know, you know, what really happened, what your story is, and you know, hopefully we can get there today.
Yeah, that'd be good. And the Santas are, of course, good people. So I'm glad you know them, mm-hmm. and they're vested, if you will, in creating opportunity, second chance, criminal justice reform. And so tip hat to them. And I'm sure, I don't know who else was there, but to everyone that was there as well.
Yeah. So, Babs, if it's all right, why don't we ask Mayor Ganim to kind of like go into a story, like what happened and you know, what it meant to you.
I think the question I most want to know is when you're out there talking about who you are and what you are, what is the most misunderstood thing that people think about who you are?
Great question.
So this is what I hear, not what I see or feel when I get to the opportunity to engage with people personally. Mm-hmm. what I hear from people that are around me, that are close to me, that are out there engaging maybe as, I don't like the word surrogates, but as an extension of me or the people that know me, is that they're the dominant perspective, whether I like it or not, no matter how many years, it's like you can do 100 things right and say one thing wrong, and I certainly did more than one thing wrong. Mm-hmm. But you do one thing wrong, and sometimes you can be defined in many ways mm-hmm. only by that, because look at how much time does whoever, hundreds of thousands or more than that, people have to spend on any one topic, never mind one individual.
Yep.
So they remember one little piece of it, right? Like mm-hmm. we all do. Mm-hmm. And they'll remember maybe a headline that says convicted of municipal corruption, blah, 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 all that, or a picture of standing in front of the courthouse and that. So that's an element. Certainly that's a part of my life, and we're going to talk about it. But I'd like to think that the bigger picture, the broader kind of view definition has a lot more to it than that. And in many ways, the opportunity that I was given, hardly fought certainly, but given to come back, if you will, I don't know what come back really means, but to re-enter willingly into the public eye early on in 2015, considering running for mayor, I hope began a process of trying to show people there was a lot more that they should learn about me.
Mm-hmm.
With a willingness to kind of say, you know what, you can, if you want to, the word that was shared to me earlier that sticks in the back of my mind is persevere. Mm-hmm. No matter what your challenges are, no matter what the perceptions are, if you understand and know the reality and you persist in making that reality something that you're committed to, then you will succeed at whatever it is, in some degree, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be, you can win or lose an election, you can still succeed.
Mm-hmm.
You could get the job you want or not succeed. You could, whatever those challenges are in life. Mm-hmm. So, soundbite, which I don't like to do, soundbite your answer. I think it's, the perception is that all they know about me is, was convicted of municipal corruption, now he's back as mayor, ?
Yeah.
I think that's probably kind of a little, whether I like it or mm-hmm. not, that's a scenario for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a good scenario, but that, you know what, that keeps the ball in your court, because then you can control what you say, and you can put the message out there that you want. You can put the face that you want out there.
Well, at least I got the ?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think I've got strong,
yes.
That's politically,
that's
big. Digress for a minute.
That's big.
I got strong people that just, that get it, that know more than that, and I think politically are very, very supportive, and enthusiastically committed, have taken ownership of what kind of we've been doing. I've tried to lead on, but I say it's a big we, what we've been doing in Bridgeport and now what we're trying to do. And I think being successful at doing statewide, again, I believe we're going to be successful, but there's a lot of ways to define success in this process. Some of it is sharing with people on this show today. Now, there's other people, and I say this because the question mark, some people, and one of our challenges, we could talk about the second piece about what we need to do, don't get to the ? In other words, don't get to be put in a position to say, am I going to give this guy, man, woman, person, a chance? Because all I know is that piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that roadblock, the visual on it is to check the box on the application or not, ban the box. I hate to go that fundamental, but it's that type of hurdle. If we're talking about overcoming felony convictions or an element of someone's past that involves breaking the law, so that kind of just a place I think that is challenging that we can go to in the second half of the show as well.
So, when I served my time at Danbury, I don't know where you served your time. When I served my time at Danbury, it took me all of 5 minutes to realize that me being there was less about me and more about what I was supposed to learn, what I got out of it.
Mm.
And I met some of the most amazing women serving in the Danbury Federal Prison Camp. And once I got over like, oh my God, I'm here. I just had to lift my head and look at all these women who were here coming from some circumstances that would just blow your mind, and that what I heard on the outside did not match what I learned on the inside.
Yeah, it's powerful.
Did you have that kind of experience?
I certainly have. I want to share some of mine similar. What do you mean didn't match inside outside?
You always hear the stories about people who are in prison who are like hard and mean and criminal and, it just plays to every stereotype. But then you get in there and I found people who were some of the kindest, friendliest women giving. I mean, of course, there's some hard asses in there. Yes. But the majority of the women that I met kind, generous. They were mothers and daughters and wives and sisters and people that came from careers and people who didn't and people who were shut out and people who were marginalized. You know, every sort of a part of the spectrum in all shapes and sizes and colors. And it just was not, it just blew down all the stereotypes of what you imagined people are in jail. You just think people in jail are just, you know, this one dimension kind of thing, criminal and hard and, you know, vicious. And it was not that at all.
Yeah. No. I agree. And so I was in Fort Dix.
Mm-hmm.
When I entered
the camp.
Well, yeah, I entered the low.
Mm-hmm.
So people don't understand what the terms are. People mm-hmm. listening probably do.
Mm-hmm.
But security level, they're defined, as we know, institutions by security levels. Mm-hmm. So I was in the low for a couple of weeks trying to transition to the camp.
Sure.
So, you know, the visual of that is, from what I remember, and you remember a lot of things, but usually your first day, right?
Yeah.
Your first days. Forget about the tearing apart with family and all that, which is even harder to talk about
sure.
to this day. But that for when you're in and you see the... I don't know what Danbury looked like when you were there. I was there as a lawyer with clients before, and I've been there since mm-hmm. to talk to people. But the two or three layers of fences with the barbed wire on top of it, and you know,
yes.
really the guards, whether they're carrying guns or not, but they got them. And you're sitting there, and you go, "Wow, this is real. I can only go so far. This is what I'm contained to."
Mm-hmm.
Is the right word? I don't know, but certainly. Sobering and daunting and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. And depending on, I guess, where you are and who you bump into, what I remember was so many, especially when you get to the camp, and this will go into the second part of the show, and we'll continue talking about me a little bit. So many young people, mostly African-American and Hispanic,
mm-hmm.
great large percentage. There's some white collar, older kind of white guys like us.
In the camp.
In the camp.
Yeah.
But dominated by, and all had gotten, I like to say in a very unflattering way, sentenced to the bleachers because of mandatory minimums.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Starting at 10.
Yeah.
And you only if you got safety valve, and again, your listeners may not know what safety valve is in a drug case, would go to 9 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then the whole element of, if you're doing 10 as a 20-something-year-old young man who, I mean, this is your world. This is going to be a larger percentage of your life, maybe, or certainly a large percentage of your initial adult mm-hmm. life. And you know, this is just what it is. Now, I didn't have a short sentence, and I think those of us that have served, you know, sometimes you're looked at as by how much time you have, and I don't mean that in a flattering way, an unflattering way, but it's just where you fit in.
Yeah, it's kind of a distortion of values in a way, you know.
I came in. I will give you a good perspective that I shared. I came in when I got to the camp. Camp is usually a period of time of, I don't know, 10 years or less.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's all within the security levels.
Sure,
but. So I came in. I had a 9-year sentence,
mm-hmm.
and you know, if I had thought about it in any real terms in my life, I just figured this is it. What's left, you know? And I just figured this was. I couldn't even stretch out. Never mind trying to figure out mm-hmm. what this was going to feel like, look like. And there was no light I could see in the top. I mean, there was false lights about appeals and all these type mm-hmm. of things. But I jumped into a bunk, and these were bunk beds,
mm-hmm.
and. You get the top bunk, of course, yep. right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, seniority gets you the bottom bunk.
I had the bottom bunk.
No, yeah. The bottom bunk.
I was lucky.
At least you got a pass for a bad
No, if you're 50 years old, you get your lower bunk
yeah,
pass.
Yeah, I wasn't getting any of that.
Yeah, I didn't pick one either. I didn't ask for one either.
I just wanted to be quiet, under the profile.
Oh, yeah.
Just kind of like
I did
slide
the same
in. You know, I didn't want to get noticed.
No.
And the guy below me from New Jersey was, and I'll use our terms, I met him, a nice guy. And he said he was short, meaning he was going to be hitting the door pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Oh, really? When are you out?" And whatever year it was, he had 2 more years.
Yeah,
I said, "You got 2 years left." And you said, "Yeah." He said he had I think he had a 15-year sentence, and he just worked his way down to the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy looked like he was I don't want to say happy, but was living life. He had his act together. Mm-hmm. He was in there doing he had a lot of talents. He was helping people. And he had his game plan of what he was going to do is get out. And I sat there and go, wow, what a perspective.
Yeah.
If he can do 15 and look at 2 years as being
near
the door.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's short, right?
I should be able to do this standing on my head.
Yeah.
But, you know, and just to share as we all know, when you realize once you settle in, you become comfortable, you become safe.
Yep.
Whatever that means. And, mm-hmm. you, and most of it's through not who you were before you walked in the door, good, bad, or indifferent. It's who you are the day you walk in.
Mm-hmm.
You're judged by how you act, how you treat people, what your interactions are, whether you're real, and there's nobody's phony in there.
Yeah.
And if somebody steps up for you, they're putting themselves out, and that means a lot. And that can clear the way for you, or somebody that walks away from you, as you know, that can create a scenario that's very uncomfortable for you.
Mm-hmm.
People don't do that lightly. Mm-hmm. So it's a real society environment, as we all know.
Yeah. Well, you learn how to show respect in a different way. I mean, different, you know, people aren't really interested in what you have to say. You gotta be deferential and be real and show respect to other people. Did you learn that?
Absolutely. And the perspective that I think that carried me in many ways was I knew I was going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. When did you know?
Yeah,
because there's a moment when I got in there, when I was in there and I was in the holding thing, and then I had to do the whole search thing, and that broke me. That moment right there, I was like, whew, you know, this is some real. But then when I got in there, I think the first time. You know when it became real for me and I knew I was going to be all right? When I, it was like a weekend. And there was this woman in my dorm, in my room, and she couldn't read. She got a letter from her kid and she couldn't read it.
Mm.
And she said to me,
couldn't read it because she was emotional.
She couldn't read because she couldn't read.
Oh, okay.
So she said to me, I hear you're smart. I said, well, I'm here. I don't know how smart I am.
That's what I said. I'm here. How smart can I be, right?
You could read.
So she said, can you just read this letter? I was like, all right. I thought, like you thought, she was just too emotional to read it.
Yeah.
She really couldn't read, so I read it. She said, thank you. When I came back that night, there was licorice on my bed because I can't eat. I have a dairy allergy, and somehow or other got around that I couldn't eat. Now, they're not supposed to do that.
Wow.
So they were trying to share. She was trying to share with me that I helped her, and she wanted to say thank you.
Nice.
And then, and then more people started coming. This is how I knew I was going to be all right when I realized that I had to stop worrying about why I'm in here, and I could be of some service.
And by the way, I know they know, but that's a big deal inside.
Yeah. It is
a big
deal.
If somebody chalked it out here and okay, right here through your pocket. It's a big deal.
You
bought it.
With their money,
limited money,
yes,
limited access, and that's.
So when did it turn? When did you make that shift? Like, what was the moment that said?
So my
be all right.
I did a couple things. Trying to look at them kind of unemotionally, intellectually, if I can. But it was a focus on. I knew I was going to be okay, but they were equal, and people used to share this, and you know we've gained strength from each other.
Sure.
You know, somebody's in there along would tell you their stories, and is that your family. On the outside is probably if you can understand it going through more in many ways so to look at that and say okay I got this but you if you focus on hey wait a minute how do I make it easier for them because they got the real struggles
you're getting three squares you got a roof over your head
I mean if you really think about it if you're safe and you just you know you got to follow the rules we had a poor addiction had to work get up and work, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, if you didn't do something all day, and I'll share things that I did, and some of it was mentoring, some of it was teaching reading. Yeah. I actually taught courses. I took, that was the way I filled my days and could share some of the things that I thought I had. Because you realize, hey man, I got a lot going here. I'm looking around going,
right.
I'm coming out, as bad as this is, they can strip your law license, they can lock you up, part of your but I still have so much more than 99% of the people that were in there.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, what am I going to do? I'm going to sit here and what am I going to do? I'm going to sit here and, you know, look at my watch. So the commitment to me was to do a variety of things. One was to make sure I did everything I could to, in any little way that I could, and it wasn't much. Maybe it was just moral support. Maybe it was just talking through, but making sure that anybody who was close to me at home was not worrying about me. And could focus on and in our was it 300 minutes you got a month to talk on the phone? The people don't know. You get a limit. You don't have a cell phone in there. You don't have your own room. You have a phone which is people listen to, and as maybe they should for security. But you know it's a intrusion. You want to talk to your wife or your kids, tell me you love and all. You know someone's listening. And whatever that was, it was always about what's going on. How can I be okay? And then trying to be helpful. So that was one element of it. Mm-hmm. As much as it was well-intended to help them, it was self-serving for me because it gave me a purpose.
Yeah.
And it gave me a purpose to make sure I did everything right that I could do when I was in there to make sure that I could ease this burden in every way I could. In other words, not screw around with people. I don't know how in-depth the risk of this. People were screwing around with cell phones. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's games being run inside the system as there
a
is
lot.
On this. You know,
yeah.
And just not even let that. Look, you can't do that around here. I can't. Mm-hmm. I got an obligation. Mm-hmm. You got young kids could, you know, they're doing different things in there. So so that was part of it. Part of it was really making a understand. I taught a real estate course, how to buy your first home.
Mm-hmm.
We did participate. I became a certified personal trainer.
Really?
Get out.
And I trained people. Oh, yeah. You think these biceps are fabricated?
Yeah, yeah,
come on.
Yeah, you're looking pretty buff, Mayor.
But, and taught reading and mentoring. And I actually led a program with the Bureau of Prisons when they transitioned Fort Dix from one facility to another. We helped construct a new facility. You know, all those things that were like tried to ease the adversarial situation, and at least in my case, and with others, how do we work together? And you had some good people in there on the BOP side, and you had mm-hmm. some people that just wanted to, you know, treat you as convicts or whatever they wanted to call you in a demeaning way, and just didn't want to deal with you. So, so I tried to take the best out of the best with that, and learned as much as I could. And then what in the areas that I had skills, I worked on people's legal briefs, mm-hmm. Supporting them. You know, the law library. I worked in the law library. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they'd come in. I was a lawyer. They didn't care about me being mayor. I was a lawyer. I knew how to do how to figure out a legal brief or respond or what should I do with this. And you had all kinds of issues coming in.
Habeas corpus motions.
And, yeah, mm-hmm. 2255. Which is I had my own appeal going at the time, so I had kind of a small group of lawyers that I'd interact with on trying to deal with my case. So that was it. So personally, back to personally, forget about the...
Yeah, Mayor,
how did I go from, like, when did I know I was okay? Yeah. I think there was a moment when I realized, wow, this guy's going to do 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
He still looks like he can get up and do jumping jacks in the morning. Mm-hmm. He meets with his family. He has perspective on what he's going to do when he gets out. And he's made it through, I don't know, 11 years already. And I'm sitting there going, I can do this. If this guy can do it, I can do this. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to figure it out. And then chip away. I will tell you, though, in the interest of even you not prodding on sharing, there were moments where I was in Brooklyn for a short period of time.
MDI?
MDC.
MDC.
MDC Brooklyn, which is, you know, is if you look at some of these federal facilities, it's been challenged by federal judges. They won't let them in, and they're saying how they throw people in the hole. I don't know if they know what the hole is. Mm-hmm. You know, without any definitions to forget about 30 days and take them out.
Mm-hmm.
The hole is solitaire, where they throw you into literally a 12 by 10. I've never been there. Probably about the size of this room.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you know the drill.
It's
discipline within the prison system.
I spent one night there.
Or segregated because
in the seg. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but in that facility, I was brought there on Christmas Eve. And it was an open dorm on the eighth floor.
Mm-hmm.
It was a tired facility. And it was the bath, the showers and the baths were right next to what was limited kitchen.
Yeah.
And it was all wide open, and it was dominated by ethnically, because a lot of this is ethnic when you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Dominicans were, if there was 100 of us in our pod or quad or whatever it was 80% Dominican, and maybe, I don't know, maybe 70%, 20% African American or black. And then there was like 8 or 9 white guys, you know. And then when I walked in, they said, hey, you were with the Italians, right? Because I don't know, that was what he said. I said, well, I'm in part of town. Well, you go talk to, you know, go with the Italians over there. Basically, I was white. So that's where they sent me.
Probably not a lot.
Do you know what?
Are you Italian?
Was video, but yeah, part of town. It didn't matter. I was white. I was over with the whites.
Yeah, not a lot of Lebanese in there, probably.
But I remember there were three phones. And the Dominicans had two of the phones. And we had to share, the whites and the blacks had to share one of the phones.
Yeah.
And of course, Christmas time, everybody wants to call, And so the big thing was, you know, waiting, we weren't going anywhere, but you know, when were you going to get to make your phone call home? And it was obviously because of the holidays, but also that facility. And there was nowhere to talk to, at least at the camp you could, at a certain period of time, you go talk to somebody.
Yeah.
I didn't know. We didn't know how long I was going to be there.
Yeah.
Whether we were going to get out. And I was like, this, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how I can, how long I can take this.
Mayor, why don't we go back while we're still in the beginning of the show, why don't we go back to like your tipping point before prison and you're the mayor and you're in five terms and tell us you had a wife, you had children, tell us about yourself and like what it was like when you realized that this is not going to go well.
Well, it's kind of a broad kind of open door. It was not going to go well when
meaning that when
7 o'clock in the morning on Three Kings Day, there was a familiar face looking through the panel. Mm-hmm. He was the head FBI agent for the Bridgeport region. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Hey, we need to come in. We have a warrant. We want to search your house."
Wow.
So, I mean, that's a kind of a turning point, or when you kind of know things are not going to go well. Mm-hmm. Before that, though, in all candor, there were people who were around me who had gotten in trouble, who had been profiled in the papers. Either, I don't know exactly what happened. Either been arrested or been investigated. I don't remember all the details, but there was this whole building up to what was this and what was going on, and so they came in. And on a real personal note, yes, I was married, had three young kids. Was living in Black Rock, and if you can imagine what it's, you know, so I was like to my wife, and sharing kind of personal stuff here, but I think we're, you know, there's some distance between when it happened and now. I was like, look, just, I guess I got it. This is not about you. You need to, you know, just go. So she went to my brother's house with the kids, and they just did their thing. They came in a very professional way, handled whatever they wanted to handle, and went through whatever they thought they should go through, and left. But yeah, that was certainly a daunting, life-changing moment. And you know, how do you deal with that? What do you do? Like, what do you process? Mm-hmm. You certainly, as anyone would, you seek out legal advice as to, how to deal with it. And then you kind of go back through and try to figure out what you know, what you don't know, what you think you know, and how to handle that situation. So that was one of those, certainly one of those moments.
How old were your kids then?
Kids were pretty young. Matter of fact, our youngest son was born in the middle of some of the controversy. There had been a couple of the couple individuals had actually pled out, so had been high profile, and it was kind of a rough time coming out of the hospital. I remember there was press there, more interested in you know what was going on in current events than there was about a new baby being born.
So your wife had given birth, and it was a joyful moment for your family, and the press was waiting outside.
Yeah. Oh. So, anyways, it's one of the, you know, it's tough. There's a lot of tough moments people have in life, but so there was a whole, you know, and then there was this whole process of trying to figure out, like, with all this going on, legal side aside, you know, the whole what happened, what didn't happen, what I would do. I think the more somewhat, I don't want to say interesting, but big elements of that, despite what it meant to me personally, and I don't mean disrespect or despite what it meant to my family, but was I was still mayor. And all this, I'm running the city and actually making what people would think objectively was some real things, were like some really good stuff happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm in the midst of this, and I'm not the only person who's ever been elected office who's had this happen, but I'm just telling you my story. I'm like, how do I, you know, can I still govern? And I'm thinking, okay, you know, this is not, you know.
So what are people saying around you? Like, did you have people who said, you know what, now might be the time for you to resign or keep pressing on?
Yeah, all that going on. I'll give you a couple, there's moments, you know, you don't forget where you have people that, as we are, hopefully we all have had these in our lives, no matter what happens. God forbid you have a health or financial or
personal. Oh, I've had
personal.
All of it.
You know, you want somebody, you want those people around you that are just going to be, you know, they're going to be with you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They don't, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And so you have those, hopefully. And the more of those you have, to a certain extent, the better off you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that times becomes family, and then you find out really on the friendship level, you know, where are people really falling out? So you have all that. But then you have people, and of course, I don't fault anybody going backwards now, no matter where they fell out. But there were people that would take political opportunities, let's say, mm-hmm. And somewhat an instance of somewhat deceptive political opportunity. I had a group of elected officials come to me after I was indicted, mm-hmm. and they now again, I'll paint the other side of this with some objectivity. I was still a very popular mayor, having been indicted, with constant, you know, front page newspaper articles and all that. There was still a strong level, and we researched this to find out, yeah. These people, are they ready to come on, burn City Hall down, or they're still like, do they still want me to kind of like continue to do the job if I could? That was one litmus test. The other one was, did I personally think that I could still continue to, what I'll restate in using the term lead, still lead the city as its mayor collectively with the team during this, regardless of what the results might be, because I went to trial.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a group of Nick Hogle, nameless at this point, it doesn't really matter, but they were fairly significant political players, elected mm-hmm. officials, who said, hey, we need to come and talk to you about the budget. Can we meet you at 9 o'clock? And I was like, of course, come on at 9 o'clock. Well, five of them came in the office and said, we want you to resign.
Wow.
And I said, you came in here to tell me you want to talk about the city budget, and you're asking me to resign. I said, well, I probably can't. Is there FCC rules on what you can say?
It's not a cable show.
It's not, yeah, but basically said, who are you? And I feel very strongly about this today. And I said this to Dan Drew when the Hartford Current was calling for him to resign. I said, don't let anybody tell you what to do.
Yeah.
Let you decide. Let people decide. That's what I think is the right process. You're coming here telling me, who are you? You're six people. If people at Bridgeport wanted me, and I felt strong, they wanted me to resign, or I felt I couldn't do the job, or people that I respected, who I thought had the city's best interest and my best interest at heart, to make that, I basically threw them out of the office. They went out to do a press conference on the steps of City Hall. They had a microphone set up and all that, and I felt it was like you're old enough to remember Animal House, where John Belushi goes, "Yo, running out, nobody's following him." So they went out to do the press conference, and there was nobody standing there, not even a press. That's not where people were at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they were shocked. There were people around me that were those close people that said, they didn't really want to ask, and they knew I couldn't talk about it, but they were like, we're here and we want to make the, there were other people I think that were distant. And then there were the ones that just wanted to, throw the stones and just say, see, I told you so, or whatever. So,
you wanted to do the right thing. I mean, that's the story, right? And it's not always easy to figure out what that is, but there you were.
Yes. Had I thought, through that process, that I didn't have good people with me and that I couldn't continue, and I said this, I said, look, if there's a point in time where I don't feel that I can run this city effectively, then I would certainly step down. Mm. And I was counseled by lawyers to say, look, you need to focus on your case.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a parking ticket, and there's a lot of things to be looked at and talk. I mean, I don't know how much you want to get it. There was 2 years of wiretaps and tape recording. There was like a boxes bank 200 banker boxes of pay. There was like a lot of stuff to go through.
Yeah.
if you want to figure out, they're going to pick out the stuff that's like most incriminating. I mean, that's kind of what they do.
Yeah.
And you got to pick out the stuff to say, no, that's not really what it was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's not really how it came together. I mean, that's what a trial's about, right? Mm-hmm. Trial work. I used to do criminal defense work. And I always felt that it really is that process, whether you like it or not, it's difficult. It is sometimes unfair, and the results are not always perfect. That is critical to our democracy, and I felt that was the process that I needed to engage. And I could have stepped up, and I had some things in my mind that I said that might have put me in that position. I went to trial. I could have, I'm sure, gotten a sweetheart kind of result had I elocuted to certain things that they wanted me to elocute to.
Yeah.
But I'd made my decisions at the time, and they had certainly more dramatic results.
Consequences.
I was told, and again, to make light of this sometimes, I was told, I brought a guy in from a lawyer in from halfway around the country as part of our team for a while. And we talked about, what this thing looked like and all that kind of stuff. And he said, look, you're going to go to trial. Just remember the two worst things you can do in this country And I said, you know, and I'm starting to stutter. I'm like, what's that? Like, what did I do?
Yeah.
He said, one is commit treason and the other is go to trial against the federal government.
Wow.
And I said, okay. So I went home thinking about that for a while.
Yeah.
So let
us take a break. Give our ID, right? And
yes.
And then hopefully we can get to Joe Ganim now.
Well, yes. Before we do that, because mm-hmm. I want to make sure that we get to the question of when did you know you wanted to run again? So if you just tuned in to Criminal Justice Insider with Babs Rolls-Ivy and Jeff Grant, sponsored by the Community Foundation of Greater New Haven.
Now more than ever.
And Family Reentry.
Serving the justice community since 1984.
Yeah.
That's my FM voice.
So we got a little bit of time left. We got a good amount of time left. But I wanted to know, when did you begin to think, you know what, I could be mayor again? Is that something you thought about inside, or was that the thing when you got out?
Powerful, yeah.
Interesting.
Because it could be a fantasy.
It could be a fantasy. And you get, when your life, you both know this, and I'm sure your listeners too, when your life takes a turn, and there's listeners out there, I'm sure, that have had that happen to them with the criminal justice system, they've broken the law. People have things that change their life dramatically in a health situation. Mm-hmm. They lose a spouse, they lose whatever. Mm-hmm. If you have the chance to, if you don't, you're I think you're making a mistake. You probably take a half a step back in some ways, reflect on what's really important and what you want to do. Mm-hmm. I think,
mm-hmm.
and this has changed my equation of how I view my life or my world. Certainly, I had that happen to me when all this went down and when I was convicted, mm-hmm. And then I went when I was away, but through that process. It's interesting. I give you a couple things happen that are kind of sidebars, but they're probably interesting. I forgot to share them with you because interesting is good for listening, right? For listeners. Buddy Cianci was the mayor of Providence who passed away.
Yeah.
Probably one of the most colorful mayors of my lifetime. Yeah. Very successful mayor in Providence, but had had his run ins with the law, a series of them. And the last one, he went on trial for a very similar indictment that I did, mm-hmm. and he got convicted. And he was locked up at the low at Fort Dix. They wouldn't let him in the camp for whatever reason. He had a shorter sentence than me, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the guys that was with him, one of his cellmates or roommates, it ended up being in the camp. And he came over and he said, you know, I was over with Buddy and so on. And you wouldn't believe how much mail Buddy gets, meaning U.S. mail.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Joe, I used to sit there and open up his letters all the time. And this guy, and Buddy's a very popular mayor. And I got mail, but I didn't get mail like he described Buddy getting mail.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is mayor, you know, this is like thinking through, like, you know, this is like, you know, like, wow, man, I guess people forgot about me. They don't really care about me. Buddy's bringing it stacks of mail. And I'm like, holy shit. I guess I'm really off the, you know, it's like, you know, I get my stuff from my mom, my dad come visit me. My brother's a big family, you know, wife and kids would, you know, do the terrible, terrible, difficult drive down and through traffic and all that. And so I'm thinking, okay, yeah, you might think, you know, you're still left and some people still love you, but you're like, you're gone. Just forget about it.
Yeah.
You know, you're like off the charts. Mm-hmm. So I came, and then Buddy came back and older now, he used to wear, I can talk about Buddy like this. I knew him, but he used to wear a toupee,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then when he came out, he got really no more toupee. He realized, you know, bald is beautiful and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, he had lost it. You know, he had kind of some personal stuff go on, but he wanted to run again. I mean, he was a public person. He was colorful.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd done a lot of good for the city, but he ran and he lost.
Yeah.
And this is a year before when I was out,
mm-hmm.
I'd come back home and started, you know, I'd try to reconstruct, put together. My family was in many ways intact, but my immediate family and my extended family, but you know, there've been some changes. And so I'm thinking, wait a minute, Buddy, stacks of mail, right? Mayor, like, you know, the mayor's mayor kind of thing. He runs and he loses.
Mm.
And I'm like, ooh, this isn't, if I'm really even thinking, forget about whether it's right for me, forget about whether my family would think it's a good idea, forget about anything else. If he lost, how am I even like, you know, what's the cost benefit of even running?
Sure.
And then I read an article. It's funny how sometimes you pick up, and I'm going to read this article about our host here, Jeff. But sometimes you read, and I read the article about the demographics, how it had changed in that city, and how it had gone from his voter base, which was strong, large Italian, I guess it was North End of Providence voter base, had changed dramatically to a more younger, Latino predominantly, mostly minority population in the city while he was gone. And that was not his base. Mm-hmm. That was not his shtick. That was not the people that had kind of elected him. And a lot of his voter base had died off. So I tried to process that with limited, certainly, information. Mm-hmm. And then that's in the back of my mind just as a politician, right? Because that's, you know, a lot of what how we think. But then there was the whole personal family side. Now, I'd come back and things had shifted in my family situation. I ended up separated and then divorced. And my children are a little bit grown now, and I had been working out of state mostly. Wasn't looking for a profile, living in Easton, small bucolic, you know, town on a Christmas tree farm where my family lives, where I spent half my life growing up, different world. And that's where my kids had grown up. Mm-hmm. And they'd been in those schools and basically had not been a part of Bridgeport since I left. And, so we talked about it, and then we had done a couple things. One was there'd still been some connectivity. Certainly my family's law practice in Bridgeport. We have different businesses, different things that we have there and elsewhere. And I'd gone back for a variety of things. But we had a scholarship fund that we did for Bridgeport High School youth. Mm-hmm. So the one student from Harding, Bassick, and Central at the time were the three high schools, and they would each get $1,000 a year to help them go to college. And so we continued to do that. And while I was doing that, we would visit some of the churches, because the most, and I hope no other religion or ethnicity takes offense to this, but some of the most strongest supporters through my difficult times, let's say, were the religious leaders, and predominantly the African-American religious leaders in the city and elsewhere, and even in New Haven, came to trial with me, prayed with me. And so that was the organization in which we kind of utilized in partnership for the scholarships. And we went to some of the churches, even my kids and my wife at the time. And we went in and we did certain things. And then at some point, I was encouraged by people. And look, you take things the way you want to hear them sometimes. It might have been for their own political reasons. Maybe they were mad at the incumbent mayor. I don't know. I mean, I'm just trying to put it out there.
Yeah.
But people were saying, Gigi, would you ever think about coming back and running again? Now, we had a sitting, well-positioned, two-term Democratic incumbent mayor who had not shot himself in the foot, wasn't involved in a scandal, hadn't, you know, done anything terrible, looked like he was, and I'm not a particular fan of the guy, but I'll just be flattering, looked like he came off of a Hollywood casting with big head of white hair, tall, looked like a mayor, you know, could walk and talk and chew gum at the same time. So this was not like a throwaway individual. So it wasn't like, oh, gee, you got an open seat, or you got a guy who's in trouble, you could be an opportunist. Mm-hmm. It was really a challenge, both from a personal perspective on one, did I personally feel this was right for me, and would people accept me? And then even if I got a checkbox favorably on both of those, I got a wall to go through here. The guy had like $500,000, and had all the apparatus down, you know, was doing press conferences with Blumenthal and Murphy and the governor and like these guys didn't want to be in the same town with me, never mind the same room, right? So no disrespect to Blumenthal Murphy, but you know, it was just the way it was.
That's what happens with people.
It's just the way it was.
That's the way it goes.
No point. And by the way, Senator Murphy's going to be here in April. So.
And he's great. Yeah. And Dick Blumenthal's great. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, he was the incumbent. He was I was like the outside challenger. Forget about my felony convictions. So just put it in that political context so that everybody gets looked at in the most favorable way. But the litmus test for me, and I say this all the time, so this is not the first time, was all of that, none of it really was going to be the determining factor until Christmas time of, I guess it was 2014.
14, yeah.
And I sat with my kids and we just talked about stuff. And then we were like, well, so what do you guys think? There's a lot of people thinking, you know, maybe you should run again. I'm like, and they're like, and these kids, I'm thinking they're going to be like, ooh, you know, I don't know. So they said basically, I'm trying to think of the conversation, but it was more like, one of them was enthusiastic, like, oh, that'd be really good, Dad, or whatever. And one of them was much more reflective, saying, well, you know, if you think you can, help people in Bridgeport, you should do it. And then he went off on, about how bad the mayor was, and he, you know, it was kind of tuned in. He's doing this. Why is he doing that? You know, he doesn't care about people. You go everywhere, Dad. You see, it's stupid. Look what's happening. Look what the people come up to you. And the other element was, by the way, forget about what the politicians were thinking or coming. When I went in the grocery stores or I went somewhere, when people would, you could feel that genuine people coming up to me saying something nice. And yeah. it was one of three things. And I'll go back to my kids in a second. One of three things: either they didn't care what happened, they thought I was a good mayor or a good person, and they didn't care whether I ran or not. They didn't care. Some just didn't buy it all.
Mm-hmm.
They just thought, you know, as they do, they were cynical about the criminal justice system, and they know how things work, and they know how politics can play into mm-hmm. all that. And so they had that mindset, and so they were in my corner. And so there was a lot of that intangible. And that part was somewhat comforting, at least in the sense of as a person, number one, regardless of how they got to that analysis, but two, that politically there was still some residual positive. But the talking to my children, and then I said, whoa, slow down. You guys are like thinking this is okay. You got to remember, this is going to be like a high profile thing. There's going to be people out there that are saying, oh, gee, your dad's the greatest thing in the world. He did all these good things. And somebody else is going to stand there, hey, your dad would steal a hot stove if you turned your back. You know, and they looked at me and they said,
that's pretty good.
they say that about us too, Joseph.
But you know what they said, which I didn't get? It was like, they looked at me like I was stupid. They're like, Dad, we've heard all that before.
Yeah.
That doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, it didn't matter what people said to them.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah. As long as they were good with it, I was good with it.
Yeah.
But so, like, okay, let's go rock this thing. And then my youngest son picked up, we started a Facebook page, and he started, you know, and the Facebook started coming in. I'm like, what is this? I tease him. I heard this before. I said, that thing, the Facebook, I don't think it's going to work. Dad, it's not the Facebook. So that was my daughter. So he would start, and he'd say, Dad, how do we respond to this? I'd say, well, thank you very much for your support. We're strongly considering it. And he'd say, how do I end it? And I'd say, all the best. So our with my youngest son, our little joke was
like,
all the best.
Politics 101. Yeah.
So and then you're up to 500, up to 1,000, you know, and the thing starts rolling and rolling and rolling. And I'm like, okay, I guess. And by the way, it's not all Bridgeport and it's not all voters and it's, you know,
yeah.
but it's something. And it was that whole new element that I started thinking, hey, wait a minute, this is a whole new game here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a whole new way you do this. There's a whole new level of communication. So between him and my nephew, out of the, you know, the living room at six at 8 o'clock at night, we would kind of just try. And then we kind of tiptoed back into Bridgeport a little bit and started reconnecting with people that were predisposed to what they thought was a better perspective or a better period of time for the city. And mostly in some of the tougher neighborhoods, there was comments. And by the way, when I say all this and anything I say positive about what I've done in the city and good things about me, there's another side I'm just not spending the time to fill a sentence on. We've still got challenges there. I've fell short on so many things that I still want to do in those areas. But there was a residual positive that maintained my ability, despite having been indicted, tried, convicted in one of the most high-profile trials, and certainly in Bridgeport and the state, gone away and be able to come back and have people say, hey, wait a minute, I think I'll give this guy a second chance.
Yeah.
And but allow him to be in the position as mayor of the largest city and put my trust in him again. So to me, that was like, you know, your heart starts going like, wow, okay, this is like a big deal.
So we
it
got
was
about,
a big deal first time. It was even bigger deal second time.
So we got 5 minutes. Can I ask a question?
Go
so
for
we got
it.
About 5 minutes left, well, less than 5 minutes if Harry comes around the corner. So I know you talk about wanting to run, you know, you're running for governor. You talk about that everywhere.
That's what we were supposed to talk about the whole show. You're trying to get some votes.
But this,
let me say this. Let me say why.
But that's not what I want to ask you.
But I got to tell you something. But go ahead.
I want to ask you because I've heard in circles that people don't feel like you're sorry enough for what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
How do you address redemption and forgiveness, and where are you in your own spirit about? I don't think you can. I don't think you can go through life saying sorry forever and ever and ever. At least I don't. I let that go. Where are you in that story? Have you forgiven yourself? Do you feel like you're sorry? Do you feel like you even have to answer that you're sorry anymore? When does it end? When does it start?
So I'm going to get to the thing I want to tell you at the end of this because it fits into the answer. We may just run out of time with that. So, of course, when you pay such a heavy price in so many ways and the impact that other people have that are close to you pay a price as well, family, most dramatically, friends, people that I served, the city itself, people associated with me, second or third generation, fairly prominent law practice in the city and in the region. Everybody's impacted. And I will tell you, there was even talk within, and I asked members of my family before I thought about running again, stay with the SRE, because it's their name too. I said, guys, this is going to be back in the paper again. I'm like off the radar. And, you know, what do you guys think? And there was some saying, well, you're going to bring all that stuff up again. You know, and others are like, no, you know, if you think you could do some good. So whether forgiving yourself, I mean, we all ask ourselves that question, I'm sure, about different things in our lives, as dramatic as this, some people have more. I don't know how people ever really, you forgive yourself for making mistakes, and people do that, but I don't know if you ever really 100% forgive yourself for being dumb enough, stupid enough, insincere enough, whatever you did, wherever you fell short on, 100%. As far as people's, the I'm sorry's, when I went to, after I talked to my kids, and when I went to church, literally, and did a very public apology, because the same commentary was going on in Bridgeport. Yeah. Had Joe actually apologized enough? Before I walked into the church, African-American church in the east end of Bridgeport, the minister, who's a friend of mine, said to me, I said, look, I want to give the scholarship, but I want to use this as, I want to be able to say some things. Mm-hmm. He's like, sure. He said, but you don't have to say that stuff here. We're way beyond that. That's not where we're at. We're a forgiving community. We're a forgiving church. So my point is, there are some people that aren't hinging on the words "I'm sorry," although I've said them, or that I'm remorseful, and I think that's true about anyone. And then there's people that you're never going to be able to say enough to, that are never going to be with you, that are always going to be against you, and whether they tell you to your face or not, are always going to hold it against you because they're. And I don't want to criticize them because everybody's different and they have strengths. They're judgmental, or there's an element of their personality or life that will not let them do that. I hope that they can get over that. Just a matter of human nature, not necessarily with me. So I'm at the point where I'm comfortable with me. I'm working through trying to make all the people of the state of Connecticut comfortable with me. As imperfect as I've described myself, my strengths, my weaknesses, the things that I've been able to do, I think, with a better skill set than most, at the challenges that face Bridgeport, and I think the challenges that face Connecticut. I've renewed through my mistakes, lessons learned, having paid a very, very high price for it. You know, separation from family, children growing up, public disgrace, all the elements of... you know, that many of us share, and learned a lot from it. And on a governmental level, it's with better transparency and accountability and being able to produce on the things that people expect you to do. But also with an element where I wanted to get to before, wow, look at that handsome guy walking in the room.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Paul. Is for a certain extent, I'm trying to embrace as best I can the element of second chance that I've been given to help as a voice, maybe not as well as you yet, or you, but as an element of a voice, as a public profile person who's been given a second, very high profile second chance to help fight that battle for others as an example of that perseverance, whatever it is they want to do, regardless of what that is, that this doesn't have to be the type of stigma that holds people back as it has been for other elements of people's lives in our society. We've seen it with every group that has had to kind of fight that's not part of the the accepted majority, if you will, male dominated, if you don't mind me saying it, white, anything deviates from that has had some type of battle somewhere.
Yeah.
This is one of those things where maybe we're not there yet, but if we can force it collectively, I look at all of us here and those that are listening, to push it, to reduce those barriers. And somehow I want to understand how I can play even a more significant role in that.
Yeah.
I understand there's people that walk up to me, as they probably do you, come up to me and just say, hey, man, I'm really, they've already made that connection and that attachment. They've come out and either they're asking for help or they're not, but they want to let me know that that there's a connection there.
They feel you.
And that just because I was able to get elected, because I was given the benefit of the doubt, the second chance or the opportunity, that it inspires them that they can do the same. Not me personally. It's not that I did, but just the fact that someone who was convicted,
took courage.
Could now they're saying, hey, wait a minute, man, Ganim's out there. Look what, that was a barrier that people didn't think you could make before. I could get through my barrier, whatever it is in mm-hmm. their life. So I get some of that, and I don't take it personally like it's something about me, but it's something that's part of the profile that I hope I can understand how, maybe in this statewide campaign, to rise it one step higher. I think it's resonating to a certain extent in Bridgeport. I think it's starting to resonate around the state. I hope it forces people as humans to understand and recognize that people make mistakes. Maybe it's an example here where they can take a good hard look at people that they bump into, whether it's for a job application, for people they want to associate with, for people that become their friends, that this is not one of those stigmas or barriers that we can't collectively kind of reduce, if not help people overcome.
Well, thank you so much.
Mayor, thank you. Wow.
It has been an absolute pleasure having you on.
My pleasure to have you, to be here with you.
I think this is the realest I've ever heard you.
We give the show an A today, don't we?
We give it an A.
Oh, we got to say hi to Andrew Kaplan.
Hey, Andrew Kaplan. Thank you for listening, because I know you're listening. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Jeff.
Next time, John Santa on the 16th. Yes. Love you, Babs.
Love you too, Jeff. Okay. This is a good show today.
Good show.
Thank you, Mayor. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Mayor. Pleasure.
Good luck to you.
Yeah.
All right, Harry, I'm playing this out.